Good morning. With the attention on the aftermath of the election, a central question at this month's UN Climate Change Conference was whether the U.S. would continue to participate in the Paris Agreement. East-West Center visiting scholar Anu Hiddle attended and joins us with some of the key conversation. And as National Runaway Prevention Month ends, youth advocate Alika Campbell considers whether it has made any difference. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk. Mailani Maikaʻinaʻi is a singer with a mission to act as a mentor to aspiring young artists. She's about to launch the first graduating class of her music and mentorship program. She's with us in our studio. And if education prepares you for reality, what's the role of virtual reality in education? Paul Turnbull, president of Mid-Pacific Institute, is here.
It's Monday, November 28th. That's the conversation coming up after this news. Nothing like a little electronica to say happy holidays. Good morning and welcome to the conversation. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Beth Ann. We hear so much in the holidays about images of the happy family, and there are people who are excluded from that image.
There are, and sometimes we don't talk about them enough. Now, in a couple of days, November will be over, and with it, the end of this year's National Runaway Prevention Month. And maybe you, like a lot of people, had little clue of that designation, and perhaps it's a fair question whether months with certain causes, history, or illness awareness attached to them bring long-lasting understanding. But before the start of the holiday weekend, I met up with HollyKeepa Program Coordinator Alika Campbell. HollyKeepa is an agency helping at-risk and homeless youth. I asked him why kids who run away or are thrown away by their parents or age out of foster care seem to get so little attention.
Well, I think, as you said, Beth Ann, the youth population is complicated. There's multiple subsets of youth. There's sort of the standard go-to solutions don't always work for youth. They're developmentally, they're different. They're not, you know, sort of your standard cookie cutter approach.
And they're not fully formed. I mean, everything we've heard from brain research is that, you know, it takes kids a lot longer than we had initially thought over decades to become adults.
Sure. Their brains are still sort of developing. And, you know, it's that whole decision making kind of rationality thing that is sort of what takes the longest. So it's 24, 25 years old before your brain is really done. And then we're talking a lot of our youth that are on the streets and runaways are coming from histories of intergenerational poverty, intergenerational substance use, lots of trauma and abuse. And the research now says, you know, trauma literally changes the way your brain develops. And so you need to take a different sort of more trauma-informed approach to working with these youth.
Knowing that, then, why does it seem to be that youth services cut off at age 22?
Oh, that's complicated. There's different branches of the federal government that define youth differently. There's not a sort of agreed upon this is what a youth is. So HUD, Housing and Urban Development, is now talking about youth as being up to the age of 24. Meanwhile, FSBE, the Federal Youth Services Bureau, another funder, talks about 22. And, you know, foster care, you age out at 18. So there's a disagreement across agencies and funders about sort of what's the number. And so depending on who your funding source is, you have to sort of go with their definition. It can be challenging to sort of piece it all together.
Which means that there are several opportunities for someone to fall through the cracks or else age into a point where you can say you're now an adult and here are the adult services for you if, in fact, they will be able to avail themselves of those things.
And often it can be a challenging transition when they age out of the youth programs and have to go on to the adult service providers. They often don't sort of connect and identify with the older, you know, especially with the homeless population. You know, the older folks experiencing homelessness are different than the younger folks experiencing homelessness. And so the transition from, hey, you used to be able to come and hang out at my drop-in center, take a shower and take a nap on the couch, to, well, you can go and you can pick up your mail and you can, you know, get a cot in the big emergency shelter. It's a challenging transition for some of them.
I would think, especially emotionally, if they're not truly feeling that they're adults and mm-hmm. that they now have to be totally self-sufficient, including emotionally, in ways that they had begun to rely on your organization.
Sure. There's the best thing I've ever read written about working with runaway youth, runaway homeless youth, young adults, is by a guy named Jerry Fest. It's called Street Culture. And he talks about sort of the different ages of youth and how each youth really has three different ages. You know, biologically, they're whatever age they are. Then developmentally, they're usually delayed, you know, because of the histories of trauma and all of that. So they're younger developmentally. But then experientially, they're usually older because they've had all of this life experience of being out on the streets and doing street survival and all of that stuff. So you have your biological 18-year-old who's emotionally, developmentally going on 14, but experientially is 25, 26. And how do you sort of craft your program to address all of those, all three people all at the same time? You know, emotionally, you need more love and support and caring and a tender touch. But experientially, you're less likely to accept that because you think you know everything. And so it's a challenge.
You see approximately 1,000 kids per year.
Yes.
Of those, do you have any sense of the number who go on to have successful lives?
So on a short-term basis, success is small stuff. You know, it's the small little successes. Hey, Beth Ann and I had this conversation about she's thinking about getting a job. You didn't actually get the job, but maybe we worked on your resume. So on a short term, that's a success. You know, we're planting some seeds. Long-term success, the vast majority, we see ballpark 1,000 folks. Vast majority of them just disappear, and I have no idea what happens to them. The ones we continue to see are the ones that are still out on the streets and kind of stuck. But I've been with the program for a long time, and so I've been around long enough that, you know, the 28, 30-year-olds are coming back and saying, oh, hey, I used to come back in the day, and this is what I'm doing now.
So, Alika, if you had to say, okay, the next thing that we really need to do in this state, if you could be whispering in the governor's ear and in lawmakers' ears as we're about to go into another legislative mm-hmm. session, what do you want them to know?
I think one of the key takeaways for me would be youth are different. You know, we are sort of attempting to have a unified system for addressing homelessness, and we're taking a housing first approach for most of it. And I think housing first is great, and I think housing first works really well for the people that it works for, but youth are different. And there needs to be sort of an understanding that homelessness is complicated, and there isn't, much as we'd like it, there isn't one silver bullet that this is the fix, and sort of an understanding that, okay, we need to do things differently and apply what we know works in a way that makes sense for the different subpopulations.
A different rubric.
Yeah.
Alika, thank you.
Oh, thank you very much.
Alika Campbell is the program coordinator for HALEKIPA, a multi-service agency for at-risk youth. National Runaway Prevention Month ends in a couple of days.
This is The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's 8:13, coming up graduation day for the students in a music and mentorship program. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about a newly arrived resident in our islands, a butterfly whose numbers have taken hold in Hawaii within the last couple of years. Researchers at the Department of Plant and Environmental Protection Sciences made the identification. This butterfly is native to North America, but it ranges from Belize and Costa Rica northward. It has two distinct colorations in its native areas, but it's only seen in its summer colors in Hawaii. It has a 2-inch wingspan with golden wings and dark brown markings and dark speckles along the underside of its wings. Its English name might make you think it moves slowly, but in fact it flies very quickly. It's very adaptable, finds food from a variety of sources, and can survive at a wide range of altitudes. This morning we're looking for its English name, and we'll be back with it next half hour. But if you know, you can call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And the first one to get it right gets the HPR prize.
Support for today's programming comes from the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, presenting Holiday Pops, featuring vocalist Natalie I. Kamau and seasonal classics for all ages, December 11th at the Blaisdell. More at hisymphony.org.
Very few can achieve success in the performing arts without struggle, but much of it is avoidable if you approach your career with good training, a good attitude, and a firm understanding of the way show business works. Mailani Maikaʻinaʻi, singer, has done well with her music on both a local and international scale, learning a great many lessons the hard way. She started a mentorship program to smooth the pathway for young performing artists. She's about to launch her first graduating class into the wider world, and she's with us this morning. Good morning, Mailani.
Good morning.
You learned, as I said, you learned some lessons the hard way coming up in the music business, but they didn't necessarily have to be learned the hard way, did they?
Not all of them, no.
Some do. I mean, inevitably, it'd be foolish to think you're going to get into that world without it. But what was it like for you?
Well, I started learning at a very young age. My first performance in public was actually at the age of 16.
Uh-huh.
And I came up in multiple groups, having started as a backup vocalist. And then I started in another band called Kiahi Vai. And we went on to win a few awards, Most Promising Group of the Year and also Group of the Year. I remember being like 19 years old winning that award, and it's still very, they're fond memories of mine. But at the same time, coming up from that time to now, I'm now 36, 20 years later, it's been amazing how this journey of music has been for me. And being able to give back to young kids that want to come up in the music industry, that may not want to perform but might want to write songs for other artists, mm-hmm. and also give them a path of understanding how to present your stories and your songs, and how to also understand being in a sound room such as this and vocally prepare yourself.
Sure.
I mean, there's so many things that this mentorship has been able to give my 7 artists that I'm currently working with.
Well, when you start out, you know, you're a talented kid, and the people in your family and your friends tell you you're pretty good. And you start, you know, you watch The Voice on television, and you think maybe that could be me. But a lot of people might get unrealistic expectations from that.
Most definitely. I think our kids are living in an age where they're seeing and hearing so many different things rapidly all at once.
Mm-hmm.
And putting themselves out there is an entirely different thing for them to be able to do.
Yeah. one of the first things you're going to discover is that there are a lot of people who are also pretty good, right?
Yes.
That's a tough one in a lot of ways. You've said that you did a little YouTube video about your mentorship program and said that in your career there were a lot of, you know, there were some tough times, some tears.
Sure.
From what?
Well, sometimes you get into different situations in your relationships. You know, I think teaching each other at any age about how to manage your own emotions and how to manage your relationships is very important to learn. And how do we learn our very most basic relationships? Well, we grow up with a mother and a father. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we have siblings. We grow up with these familial relationships. And that's how we take those relationships and understand how we relate to others outside of that family nucleus.
Right, right.
And that doesn't necessarily give you the skills to understand how to relate to people when you're working and when you have business relationships, you know, in the workplace, in the working field, on stage, off stage. And so I would have to say my hard times came out of understanding relating to other people in different situations. Mm-hmm. And also making agreements between each other. You know, when you have a manager, there's agreements in place and living up to those agreements and how you keep each other in your relationship accountable to those agreements. So I would have to say I learned a lot of different ways to communicate my feelings and trying to take my emotions out of those agreements as well.
For a performer, if you don't communicate your wishes and your feelings, you can get rolled over.
Oh, yeah. You can get rolled over. The life is just sucked out of you. And how can you perform? I mean, your entire emotions of performing is what draws people to follow you, to want to sing the songs that you're singing. And so how do you, as an artist, be able to turn off that emotional button? It's pretty tough for a lot of us.
Yeah, I would imagine. And I think another thing that's pretty tough is, you know, the phenomenon, practically universal phenomenon of stage fright, right? It's one thing to sing at a party with an approving group of family and friends around you. Everybody says you sound great. What else are they going to say, right? But an audience, you know, the first time you get a really big audience out there, that's something different, isn't it?
Oh, most definitely. I mean, not everyone is going to be your fan. Not everyone is going to be your best friend. And you're not going to have thousands of likes on a Facebook video or a YouTube video. And so you still have to navigate your little your little canoe of what it is that you truly want. And I think that asking yourself that question, no matter what age you are, is an important practice to do daily.
What about being self-critical?
I think that having being self-critical is important. I mean, it's kind of the reason why we get out of bed when we don't want to. It's the reason why we run the mile that we don't want to run, or simple things that you should do, like practice your guitar every day or your ukulele or your vocal runs to warm up your voice and keep it active.
Yeah.
Those are things that you just have to continue to do to keep yourself in shape and capable of doing the bigger works that you want to do in the end. So I think that self-criticism, sometimes it's just a good balance of it is what's required.
Sometimes people think they're better than they are at some aspect of their of their craft.
Yes.
And, you know, self-confidence is great, but if you think you're better than you are and you get out in a performing environment, chances are you're going to get get smacked.
Well, the market is the market is the market. I mean, for people who think that they are better than what they are, the numbers will show and the amount of demand will present itself or not.
Yeah.
And so I think that those are the things that I've been able to share with these very young artists. You know, they're from the ages of 10 to 18, and I couldn't be more excited than working with these young seven artists because I've been able to just share an insight, a glimpse of the reality, and even though the reality of the music industry through its changes, and having them also understand and expect it to change while they're growing and aging in their own forms of artistry.
Because, I'm just thinking that you might be a singer who writes songs and maybe your singing is okay, but not spectacular, but your songwriting is really good. And is it necessary to kind of shift people into different areas of their skill set?
Yes. You know, there's many artists that have been able to create a strong career just being a songwriter for bigger artists.
Sure.
And, you know, not all the, it's, you won't come across artists or singer-songwriters that want to take their personal selves and their lives on the road and tour throughout the year. But their song has life possibly with an artist like that already.
And songs can take on a life of their own, can't they?
Yes.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Mailani Maikaʻinaʻi was part of the Hoku Award-winning duo Keahiwai in the early 2000s. The artist in the first class of her mentorship program will be performing at a concert free to the public on Saturday, December 3rd, from 11 to noon at Windward Mall.
Hawaii Public Radio is grateful for the support of our listeners and for our many community partners, including the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, the Hawaii Arts Alliance, and the Hot Club of Hulaville. Thank you all for your generosity and for your participation during our recent on-air campaign.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Bronster Fujichaku Robbins, a civil litigation law firm handling major cases on all islands for clients of all sizes, from individuals to Fortune 500 corporations. BFRHawaii.com.
With speculation over how a Trump environmental policy could roll back an Obama legacy, one part might not be able to be undone by the president-elect. But congressional action, well, that could be another matter. Civil Beat editor and general manager Patty Epler has a reality check on the possible future of Papahānaumokuakea. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So President Obama used the Antiquities Act to create 24 national monuments in 14 states since he took office. Most of that acreage is in Papahānaumokuakea and also other islands in the Pacific. But would it be possible for President Trump to revoke the national monument protection?
Well, that's actually the question that people are keeping a close eye on. The Antiquities Act is more than 100 years old, and really the only time there's been a, like even a U.S. Attorney General's opinion has been 1938. So there's been a couple of court challenges over the years that were sort of peripherally related, including one in 2006 after President George W. Bush created Papahānaumokuakea, but it didn't survive the court challenge. So that's yet to be seen what he can do with it.
What about with Congress? Isn't there a precedent for Congress to be able to roll it back?
I'm not sure Congress can roll it back. I think there's been a couple of bills in Congress that have attempted to, you know, sort of restrict the president's powers. But I think the talk is that they could effectively roll it back by defunding monuments that have been created.
So what kind of, you know, lobbying, I guess, is going on both sides to be able to make the point, depending upon your point of view, and how much nervousness around this is there?
Well, it's unclear what lobbying is actually going on, but for instance, even here in Hawaii, WestPAC, the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council, has written some letters to the Trump-elect administration, sort of, I think, laying out their position. And as you know, that they opposed the expansion of the monument all along. They are moving ahead, however, with creating some regulations that would govern that area as if it were protected. There's been some East Coast fishing industry groups who have sort of tried to convince their version of WestPAC to ease up and allow some access, particularly on the New Atlantic Monument that Obama created.
Any word from U.S. Senator Brian Schatz? I mean, he was the one who officially proposed expanding Papahānaumoku. Okay, did we get anything back from him in terms of what is going on in Washington?
So, surprisingly, no. Nathan Eagle, our reporter who's been covering this issue and has had good conversations with Senator Schatz all along, could not get him to talk about this. So we don't know what Senator Schatz thinks about this.
So I guess we're going to have to be in that position of having to wait and see, which is kind of how we've been with a lot of policies and wonderment what may be happening both nationally and internationally.
Yes, that's true. There's certainly a lot of angst and hand-wringing on all sides on all issues now that, you know, we have a new president about to come into office.
All right. Well, that's where we're going to leave it for today. But thanks very much, Patty. Good to have you step in for a chat, and we hope he gets better soon.
Me too, Beth Ann.
Got you up early this morning.
Yeah.
All right, Patty.
Thank you so much.
Thanks again for joining us. Patty Epler is the editor and general manager of Civil Beat, and we'll talk to Chad Blair once he gets better. Earlier today, we considered what might happen to President Obama's environmental legacy with the change of administration. That was also a big part of the conversation at this month's Conference of the Parties to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. The COP22 continued the work on the Paris Agreement despite anxiety over future U.S. involvement. Visiting East-West Center scholar Anu Hittel was in Marrakesh for the meeting, and she joins us now with some of the key takeaways. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for giving us your bird's eye view as you were there. When you arrived, how much anxiety was there over the coming administration change?
I arrived in the second week, so that was about a week later after the elections. And I would say that people had been coming around a little bit. My colleague who'd been there the first week said that she was the Americans were very startled and many, of course, shattered, and that the atmosphere there was quite glum. But for the most part, it was business as usual. So by the time I got there, people had been coming around a little, and there seemed to be more of an attitude of sort of countries being more resolute about staying the course.
More countries being resolute and also more countries joining in, as I understand.
Yes. So the Paris Agreement, which was signed last year, of course, you know, that has been, people have been trying to sign on to that, parties, which is the countries, have been signing on to that all along. And so we've got 114 as of this morning, and it's 197 parties. So they're signing on, and hopefully that will keep happening.
So is there this idea that perhaps there might be greater international peer pressure for the UN, for the U.S. to stay involved? Or is there the sense of whether whatever the U.N. decides to do will be, you know, regardless of whatever U.S. involvement there may be?
Well, I think everybody is really not wanting to, nobody's wanting to do what happened with the Kyoto Protocol, which is the U.S. pulled out of the Kyoto Protocol, and no one wants that, a repeat of that. So countries are really gunning for the U.S. to stay in the agreement. China has expressed that, the EU. So these are the two of the four biggest polluters. So I think we just have to stay tuned as to what will actually happen, but there is certainly more resolution amongst the countries, especially the big polluters, that we want the U.S. to stay in because that's the way we can all go forward.
And what about monies pledged and the adaptation fund?
Well, there are still monies in the adaptation fund. The Green Climate Fund is the one that everyone is wondering what's going to happen. So it's $100 billion that countries had promised to pay into that fund by 2020. And what's happened is that only about 11 or 12 billion of that has actually been realized. Of that, the U.S. pledged 3 billion. And with the results of the elections, I don't think that 3 billion is going to be coming. So what I think that's a signal that will send a signal, but I don't think it will stop the work.
So even though the money is pledged, clearly it's not been paid in. And going forward, is there a sense that that the U.S. might, in fact, just simply not do anything at all, which is sort of tantamount to pulling out?
Of course, the U.S. could do nothing at all, but that would be at the government level, at the national government level. There is already so much action going on at the cities level and the state level and at the corporation level, corporations that transcend national boundaries, as well as institutions like the IUCN, which put up the World Conservation Congress here in Honolulu in September. So these are non-governmental bodies that supersede the nation state. And so I think there is already so much work going on and so much momentum that the U.S. pulling out, of course, that would be a huge signal, but the U.S. to do nothing, there would still be work going on and there would never be nothing.
You mentioned international corporations, of somewhat 200 of them that have pledged to become involved or are involved already?
That's right. So international business corporations, they've been involved for a while. They're developing solar. In Marrakesh, it was wonderful to see there was a green zone area where the businesses could showcase what they've been doing. I had colleagues and friends who were there from the European Bank of Reconstruction and Development working on North Africa solar energy issues. So these are all things that they're actually trying to find and are finding financing for solar and wind energy and renewable energy in general. So these projects are going ahead because they make business sense.
And what about companies that do business sort of, you know, all over the world? I'm thinking about companies like Sony and Walmart.
Yes, well, I mean, I think there is a pledge to work with the sustainable development goals in general, and whether or not they end up doing it with the Paris Agreement, that remains to be seen. But certainly, I think all of these things are converging into working with those 17 sustainable development goals that the UN had put forward. And the first goal, of course, is no poverty. So that really, I mean, it overlaps with climate, but there are so many other things involved.
So looking forward over this next year, what's coming down the pike? What do you think that we should be focusing on as we watch what comes out of the COP?
Well, the COP meeting, there is really, it's a sort of sit down and work out what the Paris Agreement is going to look like. So there were 35 decisions that were taken. They're all rather technical and maybe not as flashy. I think what was disappointing, though, is that the media did not cover it so much, because this really sets the stage for public understanding of the negotiations and support for climate change issues, which, as we know, are so important. That support is so important, especially in the United States and in this coming very likely hostile administration.
Anu, before you leave, though, don't they have to finalize the rules for the Paris Agreement by 2018? I mean, that's not very far away.
Right, and that's what they're working on. So the U.S., generally, the attitude was, how can we Trump-proof the agreement? And by that, they meant, you know, what are the things that Trump could actually do so the U.S. could pull out of the UNFCCC, which is the Framework Convention on Climate Change, and that the U.S. could do in about a year. The U.S. could also pull out of the Paris Agreement, and that would take 4 years. So, and of course, as you mentioned before, the U.S. could do nothing at all.
All right. Well, clearly we have to wait and see what's going to happen, because right now there's just a lot of conjecture. But thanks very much for letting us know what you saw while you were there in Marrakesh.
Thank you for having me.
Anu Hiddle is a visiting scholar at the East-West Center working on climate change issues and leads an observer delegation of students from Washington University in St. Louis to the UN climate change meetings every year.
Helping people.
Made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. Every morning, right after fully caffeinating himself with strong black tea, my Uncle John set three goals to be accomplished each day. They needn't be big goals, and usually they weren't, but the practice made certain he achieved what he set out to do that day. Stan Izumigawa was another who practiced this daily routine, and it worked for him, too. He was a highly decorated veteran of World War II whose friends and family thought of him as a Renaissance man because when he retired, after serving as an educator and a school principal, he took on many new activities such as windsurfing and cycling. He even started a garden so he could grow his own food. Before he passed, he set aside a portion of his estate to create the 100th Infantry Battalion Veterans Stanley Izumigawa Scholarship Fund to benefit descendants of members of the 100th Infantry Battalion. This ensures future generations have a firm foundation upon which to build their lives. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
Tonight at 5, it's the Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, diabetes in itself is trouble enough, but it also can lead to lots of other trouble, can't it?
Absolutely. It's not just about the sugars. You know, when we talk about diabetes, there really isn't an organ in the body that isn't potentially affected by having high sugars chronically in your bloodstream. So we're going to talk today about what are the effects on eyes, kidneys, heart, blood vessels, you name it, and why it's important not just to monitor your sugars, but really to monitor these other things too.
So a first step would be just generally cutting down on sugars.
Well, get a diagnosis. And if you have high sugars, then you're absolutely right. Start cutting down how much of those that you're putting in the body, mm-hmm. because that will help to reduce how much stays in the body inappropriately.
Mm-hmm. Are there other ways to get sugars out of your system if you have high sugars?
Absolutely. Exercise. When you burn that sugar as fuel, as energy for the activity that you're doing, it actually lowers the sugar in the bloodstream. In people without diabetes, they're able to get sugar in their body if they use all that's there that they've eaten from their meal. But in people with diabetes, it really helps to reduce the sugar that's floating around in their bloodstream. And it's another way, if you've already eaten that piece of cake, that you can reduce your sugars and help your body.
So if you have eaten that piece of cake, you better hit the gym, go for a walk.
Outside. It's one of the easiest things to do. And we're lucky enough to have such nice weather that you really don't have to bundle up to do so.
No excuse, then, not to exercise. Thanks, Kathy.
Thank you.
That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak, tonight at 5.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, whose students contribute 60,000 hours of community service annually. Learn more at sacredhearts.org.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look at what's happening in the massive universe around our very small planet, as well as what to look for in our dark island skies. And as usual, we turn to the expertise of our friend Christopher Phillips and welcome him back now. Hey, Christopher, what's going on?
Hey, Dave, how's it going? So this week, stargazers, keep your eyes peeled for three planets that will be wandering through our skies. We have Venus, Mars, and Saturn. Now, Venus will be setting at 8 p.m., Mars at 10 p.m., and Saturn at 6 p.m. The moon this week will be making its way from a slim crescent to a quarter moon phase as the week goes on. This will make for great stargazing, even as it gets brighter.
And I understand that we are learning more about a recent discovery in our solar system that relates to water ice, and I'm not talking about the Italian lemon water ice that's common on the East Coast, correct?
Correct. We return to the red planet Mars and to a remarkable discovery that has been made by a NASA spacecraft, the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. It has discovered an enormous deposit of water ice just below the Martian surface. In fact, this deposit of ice is thought to contain enough water to rival that of Lake Superior. That's about 3 quadrillion gallons of it. The exciting thing about this deposit is not only the sheer volume of water, but the fact that it is so close to the surface you could practically dig your way down to it with a shovel.
And how close is it to the surface?
Well, radar measurements on the spacecraft estimate that it could be as close as 3 feet below the surface, and maybe as deep as 33 feet in other places. This makes it tantalizingly close for any future human explorers to the Red Planet.
And how do they think the ice ended up there?
Well, it's possible that what we have found is water ice due to the accumulation of snowfall on Mars. And indeed, this would make sense due to the fact that there is a huge buildup of water ice at the Martian poles.
Does that mean that people would want to land close to the poles or close to where they discovered this ice?
Definitely close to where they discovered the ice. Resources on Mars are extremely scarce, to say the least, and this water would be key for any future Martian colony. From it, we could produce water to grow food, oxygen for plants, people, and animals, as well as fuel for spacecraft and power for the colony.
So that means when they start sending people, they got to bring skis and snowmobiles with them.
Maybe a snowboard, too.
That's what you'd be bringing. It's another fun report with Christopher Phillips. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week for Stargazer.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, providing environmentally sustainable architecture, interior design, and research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
In this morning's backyard quiz, we're thinking about an interloper, an introduced species of butterfly whose numbers have only recently taken hold in Hawaii. Its home territory is the southern United States, but it is seen as far north as Canada and as far south as Brazil. It was first seen in December 2013 in Waialua on Oahu's north shore, and within a year had become common on Maui, with additional sightings on Kauai, Molokai, Hawaii Island, and Ko'olawe. For some reason, scientists haven't yet figured out, it's only found in Hawaii in its summer coloration, which is golden yellow with dark brown markings and a 2-inch wingspan. One of its distinctive traits is its very rapid flight. To date, it's not considered a threat to native species. University of Hawaii at Manoa Professor Daniel Rubinoff says, the butterfly is unlikely to build up numbers sufficient to threaten ornamental plants, and it has not been recorded feeding on any native Hawaiian plants at this time. While Hawaii has again dodged a bullet with this probably harmless introduction, it does go to show that we need to contribute more resources toward quarantine. He's talking about the sleepy orange butterfly, and nobody got that today. So we'll look for a winner tomorrow, and at 8:48. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. It's no secret that technology is revolutionizing the way we interact with one another, the ways we entertain ourselves, and inevitably, the way we learn. There's vast potential to virtual reality devices, for example, but for the most part, schools have been slow to adapt. Not so Mid-Pacific Institute, whose president, Paul Turnbull, is an enthusiastic advocate of so-called immersive technology. He's bringing virtual reality into the classroom, and he's with us in our studio. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
What does a virtual reality setup do? I mean, what's it like to put one of those things on?
Well, essentially, if you think about any time somebody has said, close your eyes and imagine a scene or imagine a particular place, it takes that imaginary life or that imaginary setup that you just put in your own head and it embodies it in a stereoscopic headset that you actually wear. And will basically immerse you in any particular environment, either animated or man-made.
What are some of the environments in which your MidPac students have been immersed?
Well, the Mid-Pacific students right now are doing a couple of really great things. It starts, first of all, with the fact that we believe that technology is a tool, and the tool is made for storytelling. Mm-hmm. And the stories should be about our communities and how we operate and interact within those communities. So having started with that foundation, our students are either animating, creating worlds with 3D animation, pardon me, or they're also taking 360-degree video with through a partnership with GoPro, and they're going out into the community to capture pieces of those communities as they change. And we want to make sure that our students have essentially the ability to play the role of historian and futurist at the same time.
We talked in the past, we've talked about a project where they're doing this on the Big Island, which is, of course, changing in the volcano area, is changing, you know, within in real time, right?
That's right. And, you know, there's two reasons to do that. First of all, exactly as you had mentioned, that the landscape is changing in real time. And rather than going back and saying, do you remember when, or trying to find different two-dimensional photographs of things?
Yeah.
It's another world entirely when you can immerse a student and you can take away any barriers of geography or cost, certainly travel and time, and let that student experience a space for the purpose of, you know, the individual's purpose in life. You know, is this being part of a community? Is it interacting with an environment? Is it learning about a history that perhaps didn't make it onto the pages in class? And by using crazy cool technology, we can allow kids to then create content rather than just be consumers of the content.
One of the things about immersive technology, you compared wearing a virtual reality headset to imagining something in your head. And I'm just wondering if being immersed like that, does it in a way, does one's ability to imagine things without any help atrophy as a result of that?
I don't think, certainly with the newness of the technology, no. I don't think that we would ever lose our creative function. In fact, what I think would end up happening is that the creative function would increase dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to wit, we have a few students who are in traditional two-dimensional art classes, think, you know, drawing and painting back when we were in school.
Right.
And they, through the use of the HTC Vive, are now sitting and creating art in three dimension. And the creativity that comes from that is the ability to understand that you can interact and change your world rather than just simply be a part of somebody else's world.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can do that, if you can take the real world at large and then you can immerse yourself in that in a virtual way, but then you can create something that's different and perhaps problem solve something that didn't exist before,
mm-hmm.
it means that you're a participant and you're not an observer. And that's why I think that the creative aspect will be alive and well all the way through the future.
It's probably something that we have, you know, that can't ultimately be suppressed, but what you're describing is an expansion of creative capabilities, yeah?
Exactly right. And, you know, the ability for students to understand that the non-gaming uses of virtual reality, I think, are going to grow exponentially over the next 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the technological world, 5 years is a lifetime. But really what we're seeing right now is that, you know, different VR headsets are coming out, the Samsung Gear, the Oculus Rift, the HTC Vive. A lot of the content is driven by gaming. And
yeah.
We believe that while gaming is certainly something that is very popular and certainly a revenue-generating industry, students should be storytellers first. They should be community members and participants second.
Mm-hmm.
And when you put those two things together, the non-gaming applications are going to grow exponentially. And we believe it's important to be at the forefront of that movement right now.
It almost makes you wonder why this wasn't the first application of virtual reality in education rather than creating these immersive things which do kind of make you a passive participant a little bit.
Mm-hmm. I think actually the entertainment industry tells us the history of why. If you think about the things that we've seen in science or sci-fi movies for decades,
mm-hmm.
things that were absolutely ridiculous. There's no way these things are going to happen. Fast forward to today, and a lot of those things are happening.
Yeah.
Right. So you have the entertainment industry and the creatives coming up with these crazy ideas because it's really fun to think of. Well, technology is keeping up, and the same thing is happening in education. the VR world, essentially. Gaming is the entertainment industry of that, and all the other applications are going to catch up. But the technology allows that thing to happen, and I just love that, you know, as adults we can give the tools to kids, we can guide them ever so slightly, and then we get out of the way. They surprise us every day with the amazing things they do.
And then just watch them go, right?
Yes, absolutely. It's the best part.
Thanks a lot, Paul, for coming in.
Thank you.
Paul Turnbull is the president of Mid-Pacific Institute. He'll be on a panel at Stanford University this Thursday talking about virtual reality and education. And you can learn more about his work on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on Hawaii Public Radio.
This morning, Chris, we had a lot of conversation about conjecture. We're in that funny place where we, you know, can talk a lot about what might happen,
yeah,
but we don't really know, and that's part of the anxiety for a lot of people.
Anxiety in a lot of areas, because we're in a transition really unlike perhaps any the country has seen. And, the next month, the next 2 months are going to be a real tectonic shift in this country. But we don't know exactly what that's going to consist of yet, do we?
We've seen the video that President-elect Trump put out about his first 100 days and what he hopes to accomplish. But a lot of that is talked about with, you know, not a lot of specificity.
Yeah, exactly. And we really don't have a lot to work with yet, but we'll learn a little bit every day, don't we?
And we'll all be doing it together.
That's
and
right.
Paying attention to what's happening. What's happening for us is that we're going to say goodbye to you for this Monday, but we will be back with you in the morning, and we're going to have a wrap-up with Neil Conan from The Farm.
And comedian Bo Irvine finds the funny and shares secrets of his craft.
We like to hear from you, and our talkback line is available anytime your little heart desires. You can call us at 808-792-8217 and leave us your comments. Also, please leave us your name and the town from which you're calling. You can also post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation, or tweet me at BKOZHPR.
If you missed any of this show or want a past show, you can find them on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll see you in the morning with more of the Conversation.